The U.S. has pledged more aid to Ukraine for their electric grid.
The U.S. has just announced more than $53 million in electricity grid assistance.
We'll hear from residents of Kherson.
I heard my father screaming, telling me to call an ambulance because my mother was wounded. But I couldn't call an ambulance because the mobile connection was gone.
And later in the program, we'll hear the story of an exhibit of Ukrainian art on display in Madrid. Today is November 29th. From the Voice of America in Washington, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. NATO ministers meet in Bucharest to drum up more aid and more arms for Ukraine. They'll also discuss Ukraine joining the alliance. The AP's Karen Chamas has the story.
NATO's chief has reaffirmed the alliance's commitment to Ukraine ahead of a meeting of NATO foreign ministers in Romania. Speaking ahead of the meeting, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the possibility for Ukraine to join the bloc was still there.
The NATO door is open.
However, Stoltenberg asserted that Ukraine had more urgent needs.
We stated that Ukraine will become a member. I expect allies to reiterate also that position. However, the main focus now is on supporting Ukraine.
Most of all, the war-battered country will need electrical components for its devastated power transmission network ahead of a blistering winter. Stoltenberg accused Russia of deliberately attacking the energy infrastructure at a vital time for Ukraine.
President Putin is trying to use winter as a weapon of war.
I'm Karen Chamas.
As we've just heard, Western nations are preparing to send more humanitarian aid to Kyiv. On Tuesday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced an aid package to help Ukraine deal with damage to its electrical system. Blinken arrived in Bucharest early on Tuesday, ahead of the NATO foreign ministers' meeting. For more context, I'm joined by VOA correspondent Cindy Sain. So there's a big meeting in Bucharest today. Antony Blinken is there. Jens Stoltenberg is there. What's going on? What are they talking about?
Well, Steve, that's right. NATO is reaffirming its commitment to Ukraine as things there are very tough at the moment. Winter is approaching. Temperatures are already below zero in most parts of the country. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that Russian President Putin is using winter as a weapon against Ukraine. And the U.S. has just announced more than $53 million in electricity grid assistance to support Ukraine to rebuild the grid. More than 40% of Ukraine's energy sector has been damaged or destroyed during the war. And this money is going to go to provide distribution transformers, circuit breakers, surge arrestors, vehicles, things like that, in addition to $55 million in other energy sector support for generators. And, of course, Ukraine is also, Ukraine's foreign minister is there and is saying, you know, we also need more air defense system to break this vicious cycle of Russia destroying our infrastructure and us rebuilding it over and over again.
The aid that you were mentioning earlier for the power grid, is that a U.S. Is that from the U.S. or is that from NATO?
That is from the U.S. The $53 million and the $55 million is U.S. aid. There are other countries that are stepping up in other ways. Finland is stepping up big with military aid. But this is from the U.S., and the U.S. Secretary Blinken has made clear that in all, since Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24th, the U.S. has provided nearly $32 billion in assistance to Ukraine total.
Getting back to a point you brought up earlier, what the Ukrainian minister said is that the Ukrainians keep fixing it, the Russians keep destroying it. Does it make sense to be giving aid to rebuild a power grid now?
The way I sort of understand it is that it is to basically and somehow protect the grid from so that they can maybe shut it off temporarily in the face of assaults. But it is a good question. But people are millions of Ukrainians are without power. They're without heat. Many more are without water. So it is just a desperate humanitarian situation.
VOA's Cindy Sain. Cindy, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us.
My pleasure.
We've talked about aid for Ukraine, but where does Russia turn for help? The answer, it seems, might be India. Moscow has sent India a list of more than 500 things that it needs, including parts for cars, aircraft, and trains. All this as Western sanctions squeeze Russia's ability to keep vital industries running. India is eager to boost trade in this way, said a source in the Indian government, as it tries to narrow a widening trade deficit with Russia. However, some companies have expressed concern about potentially falling foul of Western sanctions. Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government has not joined Western countries in openly criticizing Moscow for the war in Ukraine and has sharply increased purchases of oil that have cushioned Russia from some of the impact of sanctions. Time for our daily update from Kyiv. Here's Anna Chernikova.
So a lot of experts were saying that today might be the day of this massive attack because Ukrainians are expecting it this week. However, today was fine, and I can say that it was only one air raid siren during the day for 12 minutes, at least in Kyiv, and this is it. So Ukrainians are still waiting for this massive attack this week. However, I don't think it will happen today anymore, so it might be next couple of days which are coming, so we will see.
We know that right now in Bucharest, NATO leaders are meeting, and among the things they're discussing is ways they can help the Ukrainian civilian energy infrastructure. Are you hearing anything from the industry or from government about what kind of support they need?
Well, yes, actually, Ukrainian government has these conversations with international partners all the time. And what we're hearing is that the most important now for Ukraine is not only financial support, which is, of course, crucial, but also technical support, something like generators, something like manpower, which could help Ukrainians to actually recover its energy system, its critical infrastructure assets. And of course, also what we're hearing from energy companies that they are lacking equipment and technical parts, particularly for this renovation works. And what we're also hearing that a lot of international partners from Europe, from the US, are actually announcing both financial support, but also this particular support with generators and with equipment, which is also very important in this case, and in order to enable this repair works as fast as possible and in the short term.
One of the things that Jens Stoltenberg had said at the meeting in Romania is that with winter approaching and by destroying the civilian energy infrastructure, Russia is weaponizing winter. Can you tell us how cold is it now and how cold does it typically get this time of year in Ukraine?
Well, I think that Mr. Stoltenberg is very, very right, because what we can see is basically Russia is using energy resources as a weapon. I can say that for the moment, the temperature is around -1, -3 degrees Celsius. And this is actually a normal normal temperature for this period.
And changing gears a moment, can you give us an update from the front lines?
Yes, actually we have some confirmations and some details from the general staff of Ukraine, finally. What we're hearing is that Donetsk, again, as we already discussed, Donetsk region remains one of the most hottest spots in this war. And Russian forces are trying to advance next to Liman, which is in the Luhansk region, but also Bakhmut and Avdiivka, which is in the Donetsk region. So this eastern front line remains very intense. So for the past couple of days, we hear about more recent attacks on the city of Dnipro, and last evening, a massive attack on the city targeting one of enterprises. We don't have additional details yet, but for the moment, we know that there are some people injured. In previous days, there were other attacks on the residential areas. But in general, the city is, again, a very strategic point for all the internally displaced people who flee eastern part of the country. And of course, this is a big city, which is and also industrial city. So, so these attacks are also targeting mostly civilian infrastructure and civilians.
Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to Flashpoint Ukraine from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish. Who gives you a press pass to cover a war? We'll find out in just a little bit. When Russian missiles began raining down on Lilia Kristenko's neighborhood in the Ukrainian city of Kherson, her parents were sitting on a bench outside their apartment block and chatting to friends. Reuters' Lauren Anthony reports.
Ukrainian Lilia Kristenko's parents were sat on a bench outside their apartment with friends when Russian missiles began raining down on their Kherson neighborhood. Her mother's head was wounded and her father struck in the liver by shrapnel. 38-year-old Kristenko was inside with her young son when the first explosion shook the building.
There was a lot of dust. You couldn't see anything. My son and I hid in the bathroom. I heard my father screaming, telling me to call an ambulance because my mother was wounded. But I couldn't call an ambulance because the mobile connection was gone. I went outside with my child and my mother was lying in the building entrance, face down, covered in blood, and my father was sitting by her side saying he was going to die.
Both of Kristenko's parents died of their wounds. Her mother's body lay on the street for a day before being removed. Medics were unable to revive her father in hospital.
It's so unfair. What did they do? They were great people. It's very hard. I don't know how to survive this. God help me, please.
Russian forces occupied Kherson for 9 months before retreating to the other side of the Dnipro River, having been pushed back by Ukrainian forces. But just over 2 weeks after they were driven out, Russian troops began shelling the southern city from across the river, putting residents back in the firing line. The attacks have caused power outages and shortages as winter sets in. Elderly residents Ludmila Antonenko and her son Alexander Antonenko are still living in their apartment, despite a gaping hole in the wall after it was hit by a Russian missile.
The window filled up with light. The whole room was lit up. Then there were many explosions. Then it calmed down, and then started again. There were two or three rounds. We were so scared. I am happy Alexander is still here. If the missile landed 10 to 30 centimeters from there, I wouldn't be here. But I am 82 years old. It's not that big of a deal.
With power restored, the pair have some comforts. But there is still no running water, and they cannot receive any Ukrainian TV stations. At least 32 people in the Kherson region have been killed by Russian attacks since the pullout from the city ended on November 11th, according to police. Some residents have loaded their possessions into vehicles and left. Humanitarian aid is being distributed to those who remain.
Lauren Anthony for Reuters. Dozens of modern artworks removed from Kyiv to protect them from Russian strikes that have already done huge damage to Ukraine's cultural heritage will go on display at a Madrid museum on Tuesday. The works will be on display at the Thyssen-Bornemisza National Museum of Art as part of an exhibit called In the Eye of the Storm, Modernism in Ukraine, 1900 to 1930. Curators say it's one of the most comprehensive surveys of Ukrainian modern art in the period between 1900 to 1930. Many of the works have hardly been seen outside of Ukraine. After weeks of intense preparation, the pieces were loaded into two trucks in mid-November, just before the Ukrainian capital came under intense missile fire. Katia Denosova is co-curator of the exhibition.
So the day when they left Kiev was the day when the biggest strikes on Ukraine happened. And very luckily, the vans with the artworks, they left Kiev a couple of hours before the strike began. And so they were already en route, kind of moving through the country. But it was still extremely nerve-breaking for everyone involved. And we were constantly in touch with the drivers just to make sure that kind of they're fine and they were great. They were sending us updates.
UNESCO, the United Nations Cultural Agency, says over 200 cultural sites in Ukraine, including museums, have been damaged since Russia invaded in February. President Volodymyr Zelensky said in a video shown at a preview Monday that, quote, this is the vision of what Russia is trying to destroy. Again, Katia Denisova.
I think that's kind of a very important aspect of this project as well, is to kind of share the culture, the art, but also kind of tell a little bit more about the very complicated history of Ukraine and kind of and show that this is what we're fighting for. Like, this is our culture, this is our art, and this is part of our heritage, and we know what we're fighting for, basically, and that's why Ukrainians have been so incredibly resilient and brave and creative in their fight.
The exhibition follows a chronological order. It starts with the 1910s, when Ukraine was part of the Russian Empire, and ends in the 1930s, when several artists died during purges carried out by Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin. Most of the works come from the National Art Museum of Ukraine. The exhibition will run at the museum in Madrid until April 30th, and then move on to Cologne in Germany. And continuing with the theme of art, Reuters' Lucy Fielder has the story of Tatiana. Tatiana lives next to a mural by a famous graffiti artist.
A warm bath in Ukraine's ice-cold winter, in a mural painted by graffiti artist Banksy. Residents of the bombed-out village of Horenka, northwest of Kiev, say they appreciate the symbolism of the artwork. Tatiana Reznichenko says she met the secretive artist, who never shows his face, and his team.
I offered them some instant coffee. We went up to my flat. I invited them in because they wanted to see what conditions we live in, how we live. We went up to the flat and drank some coffee. I invited them in because it was cold. I had to warm these people somehow. It was just a human gesture to get them warm.
The mural of a man scrubbing his back in the tub is on the ground floor of what was an apartment block before it was bombed by Russian forces back in March. It's one of seven Banksy has confirmed that he spray-painted on Ukraine's scarred walls. Horenko was once on the front line where Russia's assault on the capital was halted.
For me, it means washing off all the dirt of the Russian Federation that just... I don't know what we did. Why did the Russians hate us? We didn't do any harm to them. And this drawing makes me feel as if I have cleansed myself of the dirt that descended on us.
Reznichenko has a wood stove in her apartment, but like many Ukrainians, she lacks electricity, heating, and running water as winter sets in. Despite the problems, she and her neighbors remain defiant. Ukrainians adapt to everything, she says, using candles, sharing each other's electricity, and getting water delivered. Banksy has also unveiled murals in the towns of Hostomel and Borodyanka.
Reuters' Lucy Fielder reporting. After After the Ukrainian city of Kherson was liberated in mid-November, the world saw video footage of happy civilians welcoming Ukrainian soldiers. However, some journalists who entered the city before government officials ended up losing their media accreditation. Oleksiy Kovalenko has the story, narrated for us by Anna Rice.
After some journalists entered the newly liberated port city of Kherson without the approval of the Ukrainian government, the government revoked their media accreditation in Ukraine. The Ministry of Defense announced the decision, saying that journalists ignored the existing restrictions. Members of the journalism community responded by sending an address to President Volodymyr Zelensky and Ukrainian military officials, demanding that their accreditation be reinstated immediately. Among those stripped of their accreditation was Ukrainian journalist Anastasia Stanko, who visited Kherson in the first hours after its liberation.
It was important to have been there for the atmosphere of celebration that some journalists who were there managed to show. It shows that Russian propaganda lies, saying that Ukraine's armed forces would come back and kill everyone in this Russian city, etc. No need to make anything up. You could see how locals met Ukrainian soldiers.
Ukrainska Pravda editor-in-chief Sivgil Musaeva agrees. Her photo correspondent Dmitro Larin was also stripped of his accreditation.
It was a very important video showing how much locals welcomed the Ukrainian armed forces. It proved that the myth Russia wanted to push through, that there was about 80% support of the referendums, was wrong.
Ukraine's Ministry of Defense defended its decision, saying it was too dangerous for journalists to be in the newly liberated city. But Musaeva says the importance of documenting Kherson's liberation outweighed the risks.
I understand that war imposes certain limitations on journalists' work, the shelling, visiting combat zones, etc. But in this case, it was too important to show liberated Kherson to the world.
The National Union of Journalists of Ukraine has also appealed to the Ministry of Defense to reverse its decision.
The authorities and military leadership should give back the accreditation to those journalists who documented the historical event of Kherson liberation.
The international organization Reporters Without Borders has also voiced concern over what happened, as has the nonprofit Committee to Protect Journalists.
I cannot really see the justification for that decision. I hope that their accreditation will be restored very soon and they will be able to continue their reporting from Kherson and other areas.
As of late November, unofficial negotiations are underway regarding the return of the international and Ukrainian journalists' credentials. No official decision has yet been made. For Oleksiy Kovalenko in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.